Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Back in 2000, the Census Bureau projected that the U.S. was in store for a massive change. By 2059, the Bureau reported, America would become a majority-minority nation. 4 years later, in 2004, the Census Bureau moved that date to 2050. And 4 years after that, they projected that by 2042, white Americans would no longer make up a majority of the population. Well, that seemingly irreversible trend quickly gave rise to two very powerful narratives. Democratic Party leaders presumed with breezy confidence that more people of color meant more Democratic voters. Longtime Democratic analyst Rui Teixeira even called it the emerging Democratic majority. And in 2002, he pointed to Florida as a harbinger of things to come.
But there's these strong pro-democratic trends in all of these five large growth counties in Florida, and that's why the future of Florida really belongs to the Democrats. The Republicans are really holding on by the skin of their teeth and some fancy footwork to Florida, but demography is not on their side. The way that state is changing is not on their side, and we count it as a solid leaning Democratic, and I think eventually it'll be a solid Democratic state by the end of this decade.
Again, that was back in 2002. On the right, the narrative, peddled by the likes of Tucker Carlson and Fox News, was be afraid. Be very afraid.
If you believe in multiculturalism, then by definition, you're not going to rise to defend your culture because it's equal to every other culture. And maybe I don't want to live in a country that looks nothing like the country I grew up in. Is that bigoted?
Well, by 2019, part of the Census Bureau's original prediction seemed to come true. For the first time, people of color made up a majority of Americans under the age of 16. Well, let me turn now to Richard Alba. And Professor Alba, first question to you. Is this future of a majority-minority America as simple as the headlines over the years have made it out to be?
No, Meghna, it's not that simple. And I think, if we look at this majority-minority story, what stands out to me is, in fact, its simplistic aspects. And it views the society as neatly divided into two huge blocks, whites on the one hand and people of color on the other hand. And we have new developments in our society, particularly the rise of ethno-racial mixing in families, people who form families who come from different major ethno-racial groups, let's say whites on the one hand and Asians on the other, or Hispanics on the one hand and African Americans on the other. And this development is really a new social change in the early 21st century, and it has transformative potential, but it certainly is making more complex the picture of our coming demography.
Right. Well, you see here, we're kind of on this mission here at On Point to push back against harmfully simplistic narratives that I do actually think are damaging the nation and our democracy, which is why I'm quite glad to have you on the show today. Richard Alba is a distinguished professor of sociology at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's also author of The Great Demographic Illusion, Majority Minority and the Expanding American Mainstream. We've got a excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. And we're going to hear from another scholar of American demographics and politics a little later in the hour. But before we get into why you say there's this myth of a majority minority America, I want to ask you, just if you could briefly describe to me, what do you think the impact, the pervasive political impact of this notion that the number of white Americans is going to diminish down into the minority that we've had since that first Census Bureau prediction 21 years ago?
Well, we, for one thing, we have very good social psychological research that shows that when whites are prompted to think about the majority-minority scenario for the American future, they feel anxious. They become more conservative in the opinions they express. They also express greater resentment of minorities. So in that sense, I say this is a really divisive narrative that we tell ourselves about our future. There's also a great deal of political science research that has gone into understanding the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. And on the whole, I would say that research pinpoints the racial resentment felt by many whites, especially working class whites, as a major factor that led to the victory of Trump in that election. And of course, he played very much on racial resentments in his campaign. And those resentments are fed in part by the notion that whites are inevitably going to lose status in American society because of this coming minority-majority population.
Right. And just to be clear, though, that resentment is being purposefully amplified and exploited by the likes of former President Trump, Tucker Carlson, Fox News that I just pointed out. It's not by accident. The message that they're getting is, I mean, Carlson goes as far as to, you know, talk about white replacement theory.
Yes, which is a very extreme conspiratorial theory. By the way, it did not originate in the United States. It originated in France. But in any event, it envisions elites as working to replace white or native-born Americans with immigrants from the global South in order to enhance their control over the society.
And Professor Albo, just checking, you're still there?
I am.
Okay, good.
Yes,
good, 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 good. Sorry. The thing is that for me, what I see is that with any poisonous narrative and focusing on how political and media elite on the right are exploiting that narrative, it has its power in part because it originates from a kernel of supposed truth. And that kernel of supposed truth is what we started off here with, in that the Census Bureau projections dating back to 2000. Can you first talk to us a little bit about how the Bureau came up with that projection in 2000 and why it did?
All right. So I think you're identifying a really key issue to clarify. So obviously, as you say, without the imprimatur of the Census Bureau, you know, an authority in our public life, this myth would not be so widespread. The problem is that the census data really are really very faulty or fallible when it comes to identifying the new complexity, kind of in ethno-racial mixing, and there are problems really in the way the Census Bureau classifies people in terms of ethno-racial categories that have exaggerated certain developments in the population. So one thing is that the Census Bureau data very imperfectly reflect the growth of mixing in families and the growth of mixed ethno-racial backgrounds among America's young people. And the second is that when indeed people are recognized as mixed by the Census Bureau, they are viewed as not white in the public data that are feeding the majority-minority narrative. And this is, you know, this is a crazy decision in the sense that the great majority of mixed Americans have a white parent. So to call them non-white is really a kind of an almost arbitrary decision in terms of thinking about where they fit in America's social structure. In fact,
can I just jump in here for a second? So to clarify,
absolutely. And I'm sorry if I'm going on
No, you're not going for too long. It's really important to tease out and understand these data because we arrive at this the current present of a polarized America, and part of that polarization is driven by these simplified narratives. Yeah. But understanding how they've emerged is really important here. Now, just to remind folks, I mean, it wasn't even until 1960 that Americans could self-identify their race on the census form.
Correct.
Right? It was chosen for them prior to that. And then it wasn't even until 2000 that they could mark more than one race, if I remember correctly. So,
that's correct.
So in that sense, it seems as if even in the public data, the gathering and the sorting of the public data, we are still trapped in this binary view of racial identity in America, that even though people can mark more than one race now, as you're saying, if they mark anything other than just white, they're categorized as non-white.
Correct. And you've put it very well by emphasizing the binary nature of the way we understand ethnicity and race. And of course, that binary nature is very clear in the majority-minority scenario. You're white or you're a person of color. Well, now we have a growing group of Americans that's really in between, but that on the whole we see is socially integrated into environments that have many whites in them, that have these individuals also have high rates of marriage to whites. So we have to think of they're not necessarily becoming white, but we have a mainstream society that is really becoming much more diverse. And this has happened before in American life. That is to say that the assimilation of the so-called white ethnics, the Jews and Catholics descended from Ireland and Southern and Eastern European countries, were outsiders, really, in American society, not part of the mainstream until the post-World War II period. And as they became part of the mainstream, their ethnic and religious characteristics did not change. So a mainstream that was once white Protestant became white Judeo-Christian.
Well, Professor Alba, stand by here for just a second because we do have to take a quick break. I'm talking with Richard Alba. He's a professor of sociology at the City University of New York and author of The Great Demographic Illusion, Majority, Minority, and the Expanding American Mainstream. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Richard Alba. He's a distinguished professor of sociology at the City University of New York and author of The Great Demographic Illusion, Majority, Minority, and the Expanding American Mainstream, where we're asking if we need a brand new vocabulary, not just white and people of color, but a vocabulary that more accurately reflects the true diversity of modern day America and how Americans see themselves, and whether we reach that vocabulary, if we can adopt that vocabulary, if that might actually help reduce perceived polarization in this country. Folks, if you're listening and you've got, well, of course you're listening. It's one of those days, but you're listening. Let us know what you think. How do you identify? How do your kids identify? Do you think the racial categories that are in popular political discussion are too narrow? Hop on social media, Facebook, Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. Okay, Professor Elba, let me turn back to you because I understand that I said something in the beginning of the show that you take issue with about the fact that I thought was true, that in 2019, less than half of people under the age of 15 in the United States were white. Is that not correct?
Well, I would say it's correct in the very limited ways that the Census Bureau can classify people. I want to take this apart a bit. And, you know, you asked me earlier to help people understand the problems in the data and the way they lead us to think about our country. So the statement by the Census Bureau, first of all, relies again on classifying mixed individuals, most of whom are partly white, into the non-white or people of color category. On top of that, in census classifications as they exist, for example, in the 2020 census, it is impossible for the census to recognize when people are part Hispanic and part non-Hispanic. And by the way, the biggest category of mixing is young Americans who have a Hispanic parent and a non-Hispanic parent, typically a non-Hispanic white parent. All of those individuals are going to be classified in the Hispanic category. So we have this very odd situation where the majority of young people, actually a significant majority of young people, have a white parent. But by the classifications that Census Bureau uses, a majority are people of color. There's clearly a contradiction here, and I don't think it comes out in favor of the census data and the way they are dividing up Americans.
So what's the solution to that? I'm just going to jump to that right now. We'll go through more history in a second, but what is the solution to that?
Well, I think there's one improvement that the Census Bureau has actually experimented with and would have used in 2020 if it were allowed to. Now, that sounds odd, but the Census Bureau does not control the questions that it asks about ethnicity and race. They are set by the Office of Management and Budget, if you believe that. Does not sound like a scientific organization to me. But in any event, the job of the Office of Management and Budget is to guarantee a uniformity of data among federal agencies. So this is why it has this controlling, position. So the question that the Census Bureau asked was to treat Hispanic origin as a racial category. So there would be, instead of two questions, which is the way it works now, one on race, one on Hispanic origin, it would have one question that appears to be a race question. People would be allowed to give multiple responses, and Hispanic would be a category. And we know from the test that the Census Bureau did that that question works far better than does the two-question way of collecting these data. It still leaves the issue, of course, of how to treat mixed Americans. And, you know, I think that an attempt to impose a binary on mixed Americans at this point is really a distortion of social reality. So we really need a more complicated, as you're implying, a more complicated way to approach this. And let me give your readers a feeling for how significant this is. We know from births, we have very good data about from birth certificates about parents' origins. And we know that today about 15% of babies born in the United States have parents from two different major ethno-racial categories. And about 11%, or one of every nine, have a white parent and a non-white parent. Those are big numbers. They've been increasing over time. And I don't see any reason to think that they won't continue to increase for the near future. So mixing is going to be a very important component of our demography down the road.
So I want to put an even finer point on it. I'm just going to quote an excerpt or a recent article based on your book that you published in The Atlantic, where you said, you and your co-author said, by rigidly splitting Americans into two groups, white versus non-white, it reinvents the discredited 19th century one-drop rule and applies it to a 21st century society in which the color line is more fluid than it has ever been.
I agree with that. And let me give credit to my co-authors, Morris Levy and Del Myers of USC, for their role in doing research on how narratives can be changed in order to be less divisive.
Well, what's remarkable to me is that I think when we amplify and spread these numbers and these headlines through the media, and when politicians do the same, it's completely divorced from the actual reality that most Americans live. I mean, again, just to quote an alternative set of data that you provide here, that nearly 3 in 10 Asian Americans, 1 in 4 Latino Americans, 1 in 5 Black newlyweds are married to a member of a different ethnic or racial group, and those numbers are only growing. This nation has come a long way since Loving v. Virginia. And look, and Professor Alba, I just want to give you credit for raising something that's really resonating with our listeners. We're already getting quite a few responses on social media. Lauren O'Malley Singh says, I'm a white Irish American person who has children who are half of me and half my husband, who is Guyanese. Guyana is the only South American English-speaking country. It makes it tough for him and our kids to fill out any boxes that describe our heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And then
Chelsea
Thorderson writes, my ex-husband's parents are Moroccan and Egyptian. He was born in the U.S. There's no Arab category on standardized testing, so he would put African-American because he's both North African and American, and the school told him to stop. He had to mark Caucasian, since technically Arabs come from the Caucasus Mountains. It was upsetting because he does not identify as white. So it seems as we have really been pushing Americans into boxes that don't reflect their realities.
Well, the Pew Research Group has done a recent study of how Americans perceive the questions on the census and whether they perceive them as adequate to reflect their own backgrounds. And the country divides about half and half. You know, half think, yeah, these questions tell who I am, but half think they don't.
Mm.
So again, that I think is a really important point, that our society is becoming more complex, more diverse, in a way that utterly escapes, you know, the simplistic binary of the majority-minority narrative. And I do think that we need a new narrative that potentially all Americans can buy into.
Yeah, and we're going to
because this one is divisive.
We're going to talk about that in just a second and spend some considerable time on that. But before we do, I actually want to. You had started doing this a little earlier in the program, giving us a little bit more of the fact that we as a nation, have been here before, right? In terms of the poisonous ways in which Americans are classified. For example, how this kind of limited sense of race influenced past immigration legislation. Can you talk about that?
Yes, and I think that's a really good point to bring up. So almost exactly a century ago, we were in a similar predicament. I should say we. Actually, I would not have been part of that we, because I come from an Irish-Italian Catholic background. And that we at the time was a white Protestant establishment that was reacting to the large-scale immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, which dominated the early years of the 20th century. One of the exemplary books written at the time by an elite Protestant New Yorker, Madison Grant, was The Passing of the Great Race. And this book envisioned a racial decline in the United States as a consequence of a mixing of white Protestant Americans with these inferior immigrants coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, Jews, Southern Italians, and so forth. And I also want to point out, and maybe not all listeners know this, that this anxiety in the white Protestant among white Protestant Americans led to a second life of the Ku Klux Klan, mainly in northern cities, and actually as much concerned with the arrival of non-Protestant immigrants in the United States as with African Americans. In any event, Congress legislated twice in the 1920s to reduce immigration. And that legislation had a racial component, which I have to point out, and that is that it completely closed the door on immigration from the so-called Asia-Pacific region. But it also very much impacted the immigration of Europeans by establishing very small national quotas for the unfavored groups from Southern and Eastern Europe. So the Italians, for example, who had averaged about 200,000 immigrants in much of the early years of the century, had a quota of 5,000. Mm. And obviously, immigration fell dramatically in the aftermath.
Well, and so, but then it come 1965, right? We have another massive sea change in immigration in the United States. Is that and so it opened up immigration from Asia in particular, Africa, many more countries, and lifted quotas, if I remember correctly.
It imposed quotas, but they were uniform quotas.
Uniform quotas, right?
Yes, not quotas that were specific to particular nationality groups.
Right. Yeah. So it's a bigger point that you're making here what we define as mainstream in America has always been fluid. That there's this period of political anxiety as the nation's demographic changes, and then the mainstream becomes more diverse de facto over time.
I think, I would put it on the ground. It's through, in part, on the ground processes as well as cultural ones. Mm-hmm. Yes, it becomes more diverse. You know, one of the things that's very striking about the quarter century at the end of World War II was the transformation of the popular culture under the influence of the new group. So television was a very good reflection of this. And so, you know, we had shows like the Milton Berle Show, which Milton Berle was a Jewish comedian who was called Mr. Television at the time. And the joke was that at the end of his hour, which was 9 o'clock on Sunday, that many cities in the United States experienced a momentary water shortage as all the toilets in America flushed. But also, Perry Como, who was an Italian singer, and others. I mean, they really changed the perception of what the mainstream culture was and who was contributing to it. And I see the same thing happening today, frankly. So if we look at movies, it's striking to me how much the movies that are getting a lot of attention have changed just in 10 years. So, we now have a spate of outstanding movies coming from minority directors featuring, minority themes like In the Heights or Judas and the Great Messiah, which deals with the Black Panthers. I think that something similar is happening. And
sure.
It means
but in America, it never happens without hard work and activism.
Oh, I agree with
right?
that. No, I love that.
But
no,
can
course,
I just can
absolutely.
I just push back on one thing here for a little bit?
And please.
Feel free to tell me if I'm wrong. But I wonder if, the type of racial diversity that we're talking about now that's creating. It's not the diversity that's creating. It's the exploitation of that fact that's creating all this animus, especially from the right. It's distinctly different. We're talking about Black, Brown, Latino, Asian diversity versus, let's call it, sort of pan-European diversity that you were talking about earlier. And so, therefore, is it more challenging now to calm the concerns?
There's not a good answer to that. Okay. We don't know, in a way. I do want to point out one thing, though. We should be careful not to minimize the diversity of the past. And I want to point out that religion was an enormous social divide in the United States from the very very beginning in the 13 colonies up until the 1950s. And that wasn't simply anti-Semitism. Obviously, that was important. But Catholics in particular were feared by white Protestants to some extent in the same way that immigrant minorities are feared today by whites. And so the anxiety was that Catholics would take over the United States, and they were believed, by the way, to follow the dictates of the Pope. And so therefore they really in principle could not be a democratic group. And you may know that, you know, when John Kennedy ran in 1960, he had to give a major speech in which he said that he would not make decisions based on Catholic dogma, but based on the needs of the United States. So today, for the first time in American history, all of the three branches of government are headed by Catholics. So we have an observant Catholics, John Roberts in the Supreme Court, Nancy Pelosi, who is the Speaker of the House, and of course, Biden, who is the President of the United States. No one remarks on this.
Right.
Because that distinction, which was so powerful, has faded.
I would note that they're all white, too, in terms of how the categorizations we're talking about here. But Professor Alba, stand by for a second. We're talking about Richard Alba's new book, The Great Demographic Illusion, Majority Minority and the Expanding American Mainstream. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to have the money ladies back, Rana Fruhar and Michelle Singletary. We're going to be talking about the historic numbers of Americans quitting their jobs, nearly 4 million in April alone, while at the same time, the number of jobs is going up as well. So we want to hear from you. Did you quit your job recently? Tell us why and what would convince you to stay, or what are you looking for in your job, and did those things that you're looking for change because of the pandemic? We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for the show with the money ladies coming up this week on the program. Today, we're talking with Richard Alba. He's a professor of sociology at the City University of New York and author of The Great Demographic Illusion, Majority, Minority, and the Expanding American Mainstream. And we're really trying to explore what is the demographic reality of the country now versus the simply white and people of color binary that's so often talked about in the media and in politics. And we're trying to get to a place where we think about, do we need a better vocabulary to describe American diversity? And if so, what would that be? And we're getting a ton of response from listeners. For example, Mickey Gonzalez says, my husband was born in Cuba. My immigration background is the Pilgrims, circa 1636. My kids had to fill out forms at school that had the categories white, non-Hispanic, and Hispanic. Obviously, they could not check either box, so they went with other. Danielle says, I'm African American and my husband is South Asian. Having worked in demography, I know our kids will mostly be excluded from analyses or thrown into other. I have seen any black groupings and it seems any white should be a thing too. And here's another one. Chiara Fernandez Faber says, I'm Hispanic from New Mexico, where my family settled 400 years ago. I often don't feel like the Hispanic geographic categories fit, so I usually identify as New Mexican or American of Spanish descent. My DNA is actually more Native American than anything else. Well, Professor Alba, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation now Ian Haney Lopez, who's a professor of public law at the University of California, Berkeley, co-founder of the Race Class Narrative Project, as well, and author of multiple books, including Merging Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. Professor Haney Lopez, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Glad to join you.
So, first of all, what is your big lesson that you are extracting from the thesis that Professor Alba is offering here, and how would you apply it to American politics today?
You know, I think that Richard is presenting an optimistic future of what we might become, but I also think that there's in some way, Meghna, in which it's an airbrushed description of what's happening in the country. And you've pointed out a couple of really important factors that have tended to drop from the conversation. And one is the way in which this sort of a sense of threat and conflict and division is being actively promoted. And the other is the relevance of the color line, white versus non-white. And so, you know, there's a story that's being told by Richard that is sort of like, look, mixing and demographic complexity are a new reality, are themselves going to drive these important changes. And that's just not true. Complexity has always been a feature of American life. The simplifying racial categories that we've imposed on that complexity have always been simplifying racial categories imposed on complexity. The question becomes, and it's the million-dollar question, who's imposing these simplifying categories? What work are they doing in our society? Who benefits from them? Who loses from them? And so that question of agency, like, what's going on? Who's promoting this? Why is it still so virulent? That's where the conversation, I think, really needs to focus if we're going to have a grasp on how we might actively, purposefully build the sort of optimistic future that Richard points towards.
Well, Professor Alba, I'll turn to you for a response here in just a second. But Professor Haney Lopez, since you brought up that very question, give us your answer to it.
Well, look, Richard's story, when he talks about the sort of, you know, the blurring of ethnic divisions among whites in the, you know, over the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, what he's not saying, and I think this is incredibly important, is that was done purposefully. The United States, yes, was incredibly divided racially among Europeans in the 1920s. Then you get the Great Depression and a sense that the country's in peril because of rising populism, because of a fracturing economy leading to a fracturing social fabric. Then you get looming war in Europe that's going to pit European groups against each other. And important leading elements of American society make a purposeful decision that they must create a sense of solidarity among groups that hate each other on racial bases. European groups, to be sure. But what's important is that the decision to create solidarity among Europeans was purposefully taken by leading actors in the United States, by government, by foundations, by unions. That's what produces the sort of blurring of ethnic lines among Europeans in the 50s and 60s. Now, Alba stops there. What happens in the 1970s? Those same ethnic lines, pride in being Italian, pride in being Irish, pride in being Polish, come roaring back in the research done by Matthew Fry Jacobson. And why do they come back? Because ethnic, white ethnic identity becomes a vocabulary in which to express white pride against the sort of pride in Black identity, pride in Chicano identity, pride in Asian American identity that's expressed in the civil rights movement. In other words, here again, we have this incredibly important story in which diversity itself is just something that's happening. The meaning of it, mm-hmm. what we say about it, who seeks to take advantage of it, how identity is mobilized as a resource, that's the important story.
Yeah.
And there, I think, we really have to say, how did we get to Trump's America?
Right.
Professor, we got here because for the last 50 years, starting in 1963, the Republican Party purposefully, explicitly decided to stoke racial division as a way to break the New Deal coalition that brought together working class whites with African Americans and coastal elites.
Mm-hmm.
And that fateful decision has led to a process in which generation after generation of Republican politicians have become even more extreme in mobilizing stories of racial threat. That's where we are now. We exist, and you're so right to invoke Tucker Carlson, but you ought to also invoke almost every elected Republican official. You ought to also invoke a lot of the dark money networks, the Koch brothers, the Americans for Prosperity, Heritage Foundation, Manhattan Institute. All of those groups simultaneously promote racial conflict and unfettered capitalism, because the one is the route to the other.
Well, look, if
get
I can just
people
jump in.
Fearing each other so that they vote for politicians who are actually working for the very wealthy.
Sure. And that's why I keep emphasizing the exploitation of these things in order to advance the poisonous political agendas. But let me give
a
Professor
class agenda. Quite right.
Yeah. Let me get Professor Alba. Give him a chance to respond here. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah. Thanks very much. So, I don't disagree with everything that Ian says by any means, but I think that he gives much too much attention to elite-driven processes and not enough attention to on-the-ground processes that also impact on the societal boundaries that, you know, that constitute ethnicity and race. And so while it's certainly the case that some of the elites have created, you know, resentments toward minority groups, it's also the case, as we can see from the rising level of family mixing, that things are happening on the ground that also change these realities. I am not at all dismissing the realities of race and ethnicity, and race especially in American life. The book deals with those in some detail. What I am trying to say is that there's a new development, a hopeful development, that we can potentially build another narrative around.
Mm. Well, Professor Haney Lopez, let me turn back to you on something, because we could spend indeed the rest of the show focusing on the exploitation of these racial narratives by the right. But I want to also just spend a minute talking about the presumptions of these same racial narratives that have been advanced by Democrats. I mean, as I also opened the show, you heard Rui Teixeira in 2002 breezily saying Florida was going to be a Democratic state in 10 years. Obviously, that didn't happen. That, I mean, I'm looking at an article that you wrote after the 2020 election, that there was this worldview that supposedly held, quote, people of color were a left-leaning racial bloc, including Latino American voters. It's also a simplistic view that's not mapping to the reality of the country.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it's also, it's both cautionary and optimistic. And I really do want to, I want to emphasize both elements. And I want to come back to the sort of optimism of Richard Alba's work, because I do think there is reason to be optimistic, as long as we emphasize that we need to lean into this, like every aspect of our culture and society and government needs to lean into this. It's not going to happen on its own. So when we think about what's the story that people of color are going to vote Democratic and that's the demographic future of the country, the reason that's wrong is because we are currently engaged in, we are being pushed into a status conflict with each other. Mm. The dominant narrative from the right, and I want people to understand the right is incredibly powerful. This is the Republican Party, but it's also the media, it's also dark money, and it's also, frankly, many evangelical churches. The dominant narrative from all of these groups is we are locked into a conflict between good people and bad people, between people who are taxpaying and law-abiding and hardworking, and people who are dangerous and undeserving and criminal and anarchist and protesters and rioters. Now, we understand, we sort of observers of American politics, historians, sociologists, understand that undergirding this narrative of good versus bad people has long been a racial narrative of white versus non-white. But precisely because of the civil rights movement, this language of white versus non-white couldn't be expressed nakedly, blatantly, in openly racist language. So it shifted to more coded language. Good versus bad, makers versus takers, the silent majority versus the criminals. Okay. The function of that, though, has been to allow most people, including most people in categories we would think of as people of color, to say to themselves, am I a good person or a bad person? Mm. And increasingly, we're seeing many people among Latinos. Listen, the number of Latinos, African-Americans and Asian-Americans voting for Donald Trump went up from 2016 to 2020, went up across all of those groups. If the narrative that we're confronting is there's some of us who are good and deserving and there's others of us who are dangerous and threatening and undeserving, we should be building walls, that's a narrative that most people respond to by saying, I want to be one of the good ones, whether they're categorized as people of color or not. And so that's the bad news. This works to divide us. The good news is new narratives are possible that actually pull us together. We have to lean into those new narratives. They have to be embraced by our foundations, by our schools, by our unions, ultimately by our government. And that narrative is very much along the lines of what Richard is proposing, a narrative that says, hey, we're complex, we're different, we're all in this together. But, and this is something that I would add to Richard's narrative, but some powerful people seek to profit by dividing us. Join together with others. Take care of your neighbors. That's the best way to take care of your own family.
Yeah,
I've done a bunch of research on narrative testing, and that's the message that
we just have 2 minutes left, and I'm so sorry about that.
This is a point I want to make to Ian. So, you know, I think that the weight I'm giving to on-the-ground processes is shown by your data on Latino identities. And, you know, I really applaud the research that you and your colleagues did prior to the 2020 election through focus groups and surveys. But as you know, that research shows that most Latinos reject the idea that they are people of color. So if we think that this is a line that's being imposed from above, well, on the ground, people are pushing back against it and finding other ways to relate to American society. Many Latinos think of themselves as American, or they think of themselves as like the descendants of the European immigrants. And in that sense, I think that there needs to be, in your account, more of a balance between these on-the-ground forces that really elites don't fully control and the elite-driven processes that you're talking about.
Well, we have.
Making too sharp a distinction between elite and non-elite. If you think about messages that are coming consistently from political leadership, from media, from churches, there is no sharp blur between elite and non-elite. People on the ground need a vocabulary, a sense of possibility about how they might think of themselves. And this, and again, Richard, I think this is actually the important contribution of your work. We need to develop a vocabulary that is widely disseminated that says to Americans, think of yourself as part of a broad, diverse, ever-changing group at risk of being divided and convinced to fear each other, pull together and defend each other against those purposely trying to divide us.
Well, you know, I have to just jump in here because we're just flat out of time. But that's an excellent note for us to end on, because to me, I think one of the most important lessons of this conversation and where we are as a nation right now is that there is an us. There is an us, and it shouldn't be an us versus them, but a collective American us in all of its tumult and diversity. So with that thought, Ian Haney Lopez, professor of public law at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-founder of the Race Class Narrative Project, thank you so much for joining us. And Richard,
thank you.
Yeah, and Richard Alba, professor of sociology at the City University of New York and author of The Great Demographic Illusion. It was a real pleasure to have you, Professor Alba. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you, Meghna. Great to be here.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.